Welcome to New World Notes, edited as usual by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear more of a recording that just crossed my transom. It's John Perkins speaking in West Hartford, Connecticut in January 2005. The talk may be old, but I find it very illuminating of what's happening in our world today. For instance, I think it explains a lot about why the U.S. military is knee-deep in Libya, though Perkins never discusses Libya directly. We also get some details about the recent past that are new to me, such as why the U.S. military invaded Panama in 1989. Hint, not for any of the reasons announced to the public. Last week, Perkins explained the three stages by which the corporatocracy, Perkins' term, by which the corporatocracy forces third world countries to do its bidding. First, economic hitmen such as Perkins try to bribe the corrupt leader into taking on national debt that the country can never repay. If the leader refuses, send in the jackals to overthrow or assassinate him. Last, if all else fails, send in the Marines. In our previous installment, Perkins showed the process at work in Iran in 1953, in Panama, and in Ecuador. Now Perkins discusses a supposed great success of the process, Saudi Arabia. As a result of this supposed success, though, millions more people came to hate the United States and its corporate rulers. And one of these new haters was named Osama bin Laden. Let's let Perkins himself tell the story. Here he is.
Well, first let me go to a case where we really succeeded very, very well, and that is Saudi Arabia. Now, a lot of you out there will remember in the early 1970s, this country was practically brought to its knees because OPEC flexed its muscles and shut down the oil, pretty much, primarily because of our policies. They objected to our policies in Israel. And we were afraid that we were going to have another Great Depression because of this lack of oil. So the Treasury Department came to me and a couple of other economic hitmen and said, this is unacceptable. You need to come up with a solution to this issue and to make sure it will never, ever happen again. And so we knew that the solution lay with Saudi Arabia. Yeah, it was funny. I went to Riyadh, and I'll make a touch upon it. I went to Riyadh, the capital of the wealthiest country in the world per capita, was assumed at that time. Most oil-rich company in the world. I go to Riyadh in the early 70s, and I'm driving around the streets, and everywhere I go, I see this herd of goats. You know, they're everywhere. They're over there in that alley. They're down in Riyadh at that time. The wealthiest city capital in the world was this, you know, little city basically built out of sand. I mean, it was really an amazing place with herds of goats wandering around. So I asked my driver what these herds of goats did. Why were they all over the place? And he said, well, they're the garbage collection system. He said, you know, no self-respecting Saudi would pick up garbage. So the Saudis at that time were throwing garbage out their doors and the goats were coming by and eating it, and that was it. And that gave me an idea that, you know, Saudi really needed to modernize. One of the first projects that happened there was waste management went in with 250 new garbage trucks and got rid of the goats. Poor goats. I always wondered what happened to them. But in any case, putting together the Saudi deal was pretty complicated and extensive, and the details are in the book, but the summary version is that we struck a deal with the House of Saud. We knew that the way to solve the oil crisis problem was Saudi Arabia because it had more oil than any place else in the world, and the House of Saud, the royal family, was corrupt and more corruptible. And so we ended up putting together this deal whereby the royal family agreed to return most of the money it made off oil sales to the United States to buy U.S. government securities, which it has done ever since. Trillions and trillions of dollars. And the U.S. Treasury Department would have access, would have fiduciary responsibility to take the interest earned on those government securities and use it to hire American companies to build Saudi Arabia in a Western image, to build huge power plants, desalinization plants, highways, transmission lines, cities. We built cities out of the desert. As an aside, the woman that I've been married to for 23 years, not the one that, well, anyway, her father was chief economist for Bechtel Corporation for many years, so I have a lot of connections here. Bechtel was one of the prime companies that went to, in fact, my father-in-law was the project manager for building cities in Saudi Arabia with this money. So the deal was that the Saudis would invest in U.S. Treasury securities, the Treasury Department would use the interest to hire American companies to build Saudi Arabia in a Western image. And the House of Saud would agree to keep the price of oil within limits acceptable to us, which they've done, and we would agree to keep them in power no matter what happened, which we've done, despite a lot of things that they've done that we didn't particularly like harboring Idi Amin, the Hitler of Africa, who just died there last summer, having been harbored there for 25 years or something like that. So this deal was struck, and it's been a very, very powerful deal. It's still in place today. But it's caused a tremendous amount of resentment, especially in the Muslim community. Tremendous amount of resentment. What happened in Iran with Mossadegh and the Shah, and what happened in Saudi Arabia, have contributed to what in the CIA is known as blowback. This is huge blowback. Blowback is what happens when your policies, particularly your covert policies, come back to haunt you years later. And we've been haunted by what we did in Iran and what we did in Saudi Arabia. One of Osama bin Laden's big gripes is that his country, Saudi Arabia, has become westernized. And around the world, Muslim peoples are furious at the House of Saud for allowing the most sacred lands in the Muslim world, Medina, Mecca, to be surrounded by westernized, by Burger Kings and McDonald's. Anyway, we counted Saudi Arabia, rightfully or wrongfully, as one of our greatest successes as economic hitmen. It was exemplary. And it still stands, as I said. So next we decided we'd use the same model in Iraq, that Saddam Hussein ought to do the same thing that the House of Saud had done. So we went into Iraq and tried to work the same deal with Saddam. We threatened him. We let him know that if he didn't go along with the deal, he'd end up like Mossadegh did. And if he did go along with the deal, he'd end up like the House of Saud, and we'd sell him all the jets and tanks and chemical plants that he wanted. He'd keep his power, he'd still be president. He didn't go along. I don't know why. Maybe just plain crazy. Probably should have accepted the deal. So we sent in the jackals. The jackals tried to overthrow him. They couldn't. They tried to assassinate him. They couldn't. Do you ever think about, if you're head of state and a lot of people out there don't like you, who's the most dangerous person around you? Your bodyguard. All your bodyguards, because they carry guns and they walk next to you. In South America, we own most of the bodyguards because they're trained in the School of the Americas by our military. So when we want to get to a guy like Roldos or Torrijos, the bodyguards are pretty loyal to their handlers, their trainers, who are our military, and we also pay them pretty well. They don't make a lot of money to begin with, and you just, you know, $200,000 worth a lot to them. But Saddam Hussein's bodyguards were loyal. We couldn't get through to them. Plus the fact that he had a lot of doubles and his bodyguards often didn't know who the real Saddam was. So we couldn't assassinate him. So we used the third line of defense. We sent in the military in 1990. We thought at that point, after the military had been defeated, that Saddam had been sufficiently chastised that now we could make the whole system work. The economic hitmen went back in the 90s, failed again. The jackals went back in, failed again. And so we sent in the military once again. And you know what's happened there. There are several other factors involved in Iraq. It's a fairly complicated issue. But chief among them is the scenario I just described. So that's an instance where the system went to the final solution, which is the military. But once again, the system is built primarily, this empire has been built primarily without the military. So here we are today. We've created this huge empire, the world's largest. I mentioned before that 5% of the world's population is consuming 25% of its resources or more, but that the real fact is that 1% of our population, 1% of the American population, 1% of 5% owns more assets than 90%. So 1% of the American population at the top of the pyramid owns more assets, more of America's wealth than the 90% at the bottom. So this empire really is about 25% of the world's resources being funneled into 1% of 5% of the world's population. People I call the corporatocracy. They're the ones that are running this. This empire also differs from all the others in the history of the world in that there is no emperor. And there's no single family, contrary to what some of you may be thinking. I'm from Florida now. I live in Florida, you know. But there is no single family. It's what I call the corporatocracy. It's the heads of the big corporations, and the big banks, and the government. And they all blend together. There's really no distinction. And you take a guy, I mean, it just kind of started in a big way under Robert McNamara, president of Ford, who became Secretary of Defense under Kennedy and Johnson, and then president of the World Bank. Then we had George Shultz. Well, this is an interesting story. This is part of the Panama story. In addition to signing the Panama Canal Treaty with Jimmy Carter, the other big problem that Omar Torrijos committed and not accepting the economic hitmen was that he began to negotiate with the Japanese to build a sea-level canal across Panama. Now, the current Panama Canal cannot take the largest ships in the world because it has locks and they're not big enough. So the Japanese proposed to finance and construct a new sea-level canal. At the time, George Shultz was president of Bechtel Corporation, and Caspar Weinberger was its chief counsel, senior vice president, and they put a tremendous amount of pressure on Torrijos to stop negotiating with the Japanese. Bechtel did not want the Japanese in its hemisphere, or anywhere else in the world for that matter, constructing the largest construction project in the history of the modern world. And soon after that, when Reagan became president, Shultz became Secretary of State, and Weinberger became Secretary of Defense, and sent economic hitmen, me and others, back to Torrijos and said, stop negotiating with the Japanese. He continued to negotiate with the Japanese. He said, I have the sovereign right. I'm not opposing the U.S. I'm not a communist. I'm not advocating anything anti-U.S. I am saying I have the right to negotiate with the Japanese. And it was shortly after that that he was assassinated. One of Noriega's, his successors, the successor was Noriega. One of his great sins was that he continued to negotiate with the Japanese. Why did we attack Panama in 1989? That was one of the big reasons. Panama was absolutely no threat to us, and it was a unilateral commitment on our part. In any case, this corporatocracy is reflected in people like George Shultz, who was Secretary of the Treasury under Nixon, and President of Bechtel, and Secretary of the State Department under Reagan. It's also Caspar Weinberger. Today we've got Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice. There's a lot of them. This empire is built on these kind of people that are jumping back and forth from government to corporations, the big banks, constantly. At the very top, it all blurs. There's no distinction. Just think about it. Think about it. If somebody were to come to you and tell you about a country someplace in the world where if you had a watchdog organization that's supposed to watch the politics of, let's say, the city of Hartford, and this watchdog organization hires the mayor of Hartford to be the head of the watchdog organization, and after he retires from that, he goes back to become the mayor or some such thing, you'd think, well, my God, that's incredibly corrupt. That's a banana republic. But that's exactly what we do on the very highest levels. We hire people out of these industries to watchdog these industries and then allow them to go back into the industries. Purely a conflict of interest and open for such incredible corruption. But this is run by this group that I call the corporatocracy. So we reach the year 2000, the new millennium, and we've attained the first truly global empire in the history of the world. And during this period, I always felt a lot of guilt about what I was doing. I should tell you that most of what I did was not illegal. These things that I've been describing are not illegal. They should be. If I were a banker and I were to go out and coerce you or seduce you into accepting a loan that I knew full well you could never repay because I wanted to get a favor from you, I'd be a criminal. And you could get out from under it under the bankruptcy laws. But in the international business, that's not true. We write the international laws. So we created this situation that we come to at the new millennium, basically, of this amazing empire that's been built. I've been feeling guilty about it all along. And I got out of it at one point and formed a nonprofit organization, as the mayor read in my resume in 1990. And at the time, I started to write the book because I knew that I had to do more than just get out. I needed to come clean on this. The American people needed to understand because most Americans have no idea what we're doing. They think foreign aid is altruistic. Almost none of it's altruistic. A little bit during times like this with the tsunamis. There's a lot of altruism there. It's a very small percentage. But I was always bribed or threatened not to write the book, not to expose the truth. And in the early 90s, I accepted a very large bribe from a Boston-based organization. I talk about it in the book. Very large. And I put most of the money from that bribe into forming this nonprofit organization, which does great things with indigenous people around the world. Dream Change. You can go to dreamchange.org to learn more about it. We've done some wonderful projects. We've done a lot of teaching. We work in the areas of changing consciousness in this country. And so I assuaged my guilt with this organization. But again, I always knew somehow the American people needed to know about this. But I didn't dare speak out. And I had an oath of secrecy also. And then came 9/11. I was in the Amazon on 9/11. I was with the Shwa people, who, if you've ever seen a shrunken head or a picture of one, they did it because they're the only people in the world to do, and that's who I lived with when I was in the Peace Corps, and they're the ones who are on the front line of defense fighting the oil companies. I tell you, head shrinkers don't have much of a chance against our military. But I was there on 9/11 with these people, and then shortly after that, I went to Ground Zero. And when I was at Ground Zero, the smoke was still coming out of the ground, and you could still smell the burning flesh. And as I stood there looking at that terrible destruction that had been done, I knew I had to speak out because I knew that I had to take responsibility for what had happened there. I knew that what had happened there had a lot to do with what we economic hitmen have done. Because although Osama bin Laden is a mass murderer who needs to be brought to task on this, 24,000 people die every single day from lack of proper food. 24,000 people die every day from lack of food around the world. 30,000 children die every single day from lack of medicine. They have curable diseases. Over 50,000 people die every single day needlessly. We could stop that. Instead, in many places, I hate to tell you, we encourage it, or our actions encourage it. And so there's millions, perhaps billions of people around this world that are full of resentment. I travel a lot. I got back fairly recently from Tibet and Nepal and England, and I'm headed down to South America and the Caribbean in just a couple of weeks. I've been traveling since 1968 extensively, and I've never felt a time when there was so much hostility toward us, so much resentment. A man like Osama bin Laden can't survive in the caves of Afghanistan or wherever he is with is it $25 million or is it now $50 million bounty on his head? And all the American forces lined up against him? He can't possibly survive without a huge undercurrent of popular support around the world. Can't survive. There's millions of people around the world who think Osama bin Laden is Robin Hood, who see him as a David standing up to Goliath. And they're angry. I have a 22-year-old daughter. As I was there at Ground Zero, I thought about how I want her to inherit a better world than the one I'm leaving her right now, than the one represented by that pit in the ground at Ground Zero. And I knew that the only way we can get security is when we understand what we're really doing in this world. Because I truly believe that the American people don't comprehend what's going on, for the most part. We need to. Everybody else around the world, it appears, does. I go to countries where people supposedly are illiterate, but they know that their governments are corrupt, and so is ours. They know that billions of dollars have been lent to their country, and they haven't seen any of it. But the big American companies come in and make a lot of money off their country, and a few of their own people make a lot of money. They know that. And they're resentful. And their children are starving to death and dying of curable diseases. And so I realized as I was at Ground 11 that, you know, it isn't the security forces at our airports or our soldiers in far-off lands that are going to give us security and give my daughter and her generation around the world security. It's only us in a change of consciousness. And as the mayor mentioned when he introduced me, I've done a lot of work with shamans and indigenous people. And one of the things I've discovered, worked with many shamanic cultures, indigenous cultures around the world, Tibet, Central America, South America, Africa, Asia, North America. And every one of these cultures, the Maya, the Quechua, the Hopi, the Bushmen, the Zulus, the Tibetans, the people of the Asian steppes, every one of those cultures has a legend, a prophecy, that right now we have entered a tremendous time of change, what the Quechua of the Andes called the new Pachacuti. The Mayans tell us that during the period from 1999 to 2012 will be a period of tremendous transition, and that we're going through that right now. And I've discovered that indigenous people, when they make prophecies, they often come true. And when every one of them around the world that I know of is making a very similar prophecy, it makes me think about it. Seriously. And so I realized in our nonprofit organization, Dream Change, has been teaching about changing consciousness and using indigenous wisdom to help that. And I realized that one of the most important things that we need to do is not just about consciousness about who we are as an individual, what our life is about as an individual, how I'm going to get better as a writer or a teacher or whatever your job is, whatever your life is about. It's not just about that. It's also really about understanding what our country is doing, what our society is doing, and how it's going to impact our children and their children. And so I realized there at Ground Zero that the most important thing I had to do for the rest of my life is to try to help my fellow Americans understand what's going on in the world and also understand what the consequences may be and what they should be. And what the consequences may be, what they will be, if we continue on this course, is disastrous. There is no doubt. Because history tells us, without a single question, without a single exception, that empires collapse brutally, painfully. They destroy cultures and nations, and millions of lives, and then they collapse. And so will ours if we stay on this path. And it's in the process now. The signs are all around us, in economics, in politics, in people's attitudes, all around us. Now, if this empire collapses, that's not going to help anybody. It's going to create a huge void. There'll be wars, and somebody will emerge to fill that void. History tells us this. Chinese, coalition of Arab governments, European Union, I don't know who it's going to be. But it could very well be something that's much worse than us. And so the alternative, what it should be, is we need to turn this empire back into the republic for which it stands. We need to follow our hearts, to follow our principles. The great thing about this empire is it is the first one without an emperor, and it is the first one, as far as I know, that's built on a people who are deeply compassionate in their most sacred documents. Just before we started here, I walked down that corridor there, and all of this country's sacred documents are on the wall of that corridor. It was so emotional for me. The Declaration of Independence. They're all there. And what they all say is that we're a people who are compassionate. We're a people who believe in justice and equality. We believe that all people all over the world have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We believe that there should be balance between nature and us, that the animals and the trees have some rights too. We want clean air for our children. We want good food. We believe in these things, and we've created an empire. And in creating that empire, we've created institutions that reach to every corner of the planet for the first time in history. Institutions that reach from this country, from one country, go to every corner of the planet, sucking in resources for us to consume. But there's no reason we can't reverse that and send out compassion and love and resources around the world. We need to create a new revolution here, and we need to embrace the world. We need to apply our values and make sure that the world adheres to them, and it has to come from us. It never comes from the top. We can't look to Kerry to do it. We can't look to Bush to do it. We can't look to any other leader to do it unless we make sure that we find the leaders and insist that this is what they're going to do. The last election sure as hell wasn't about that. It has to come from us. And it can, and it will. Most of my lifetime, my country, the United States, spent billions of dollars in untold time and resources trying to get rid of the Soviet Union. Didn't do it. Change of consciousness did it. Bunch of union activists, playwrights, and poets brought down the Soviet Union. Change happens, and it happens fast. But it has to be a change in consciousness, and it has to start with a deep awareness. We're on the verge of that now. But I just want to end by saying, believe in yourself and your friends and neighbors. Get together, follow your heart, and let's create the world that our founding fathers, the world that's truly envisioned by this country, represents. Thank you.
John Perkins, ending on a note of hope that the people can turn the corporate empire back into the American Republic. Many thanks to John Schwenk, who recorded the talk, which I have condensed just a smidgen. Thanks to you for listening. Our website is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.